You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Hearings to consider President Trump's nominee to fill the Supreme Court seat vacated after the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg are set to begin October 12th. Now, this move, which comes less than 40 days before the November 3rd general election, is being praised by some, criticized by others. Joining us live today to talk in more detail about the Supreme Court nominee hearings and appointments is University of Idaho Law Professor Shakira Sanders. Hi there.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great. I will let you know if I can't, but right now you sound really good.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, so Shakira, nothing unusual about a sitting U.S. president in nominating someone to fill a vacant seat on the bench. However, this is unique because of what happened back in 2016 when President Obama's pick to fill the seat of the late Antonin Scalia, Merrick Garland, did not get a hearing. So can you talk to us about what happened there and then fast forward us to now and why we're kind of in this, you know, conundrum, I guess?
Well, I think that if the Republicans had at least given Merrick Garland a vote, this would not be an issue whether or not it was proper for President Trump to nominate Amy Berry, a new judge, sort of right before the election. But what we saw in 2016 is sort of a new rule imposed by the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. That U.S. Supreme Court justices, new ones, don't get a hearing in an election year. Of course, that was, we had several days, months before the election last time. Here we're talking less than 60 days before an election. And so for many, you may think, well, hey, you know, that was a rule that was set in 2016. Why doesn't that rule apply now? Well, here's the answer to that question. There's nothing in the Constitution that dictates what the process is for selecting a new judge other than the president nominates and the Senate votes. Those are the only rules. And so to the extent that the U.S. Senate, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, can set new rules, contradictory rules, somewhat hypocritical rules, you can put that all into the box of politics, which governs the nomination process.
Okay, so as long, you dropped out there for a second, so I want to make this clear. There's talk about that constitutional part of it, because my understanding is that what the Republicans are doing, it's completely constitutional. Some people may argue that it's not ethically correct because of what happened in 2016, but from a constitutional standpoint, I mean, the president nominating, the Republican-run Senate saying we're going to have a hearing, there is nothing unconstitutional about that.
Exactly. Nothing constitutional about that. And although there may be ethical concerns, there are no ethics that go along with our U.S. Constitution. And to the extent, again, it's the Senate that makes all of the rules surrounding the process. One of the interesting things is that the Constitution doesn't even set the minimum qualifications for U.S. Supreme Court judges. Therefore, we've seen judges of different ages. People have pointed out that judges have been getting younger and younger, but that's part of the political process. If you think about it, our framers established three branches of government. They were designed to be in conflict with each other, which is why the president nominates and the Senate votes.
And it's interesting, too. I think you bring up a good point, Shakira, about requirements for, you know, for you know, job requirements or age or anything like that. Because once again, when we look at this nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, she clerked for Justice Antonin Scalia. She worked in private practice for a little while, but the majority of her career has been as a professor at Notre Dame. It could be argued that she really doesn't have a lot of litigation experience, right? As an attorney, she is an academic. Whereas we look at who she would potentially be replacing, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, she was a litigator. I mean, she argued in front of the Supreme Court. Does that ultimately matter to have a justice on the bench who has not necessarily been a litigator and is more of an academic?
I'll be honest and say that I am not familiar with Amy Coney Barrett's sort of record prior to academia. So it very well could be that she clerked for Scalia. Maybe she, you know, worked as a lawyer, either doing transaction work or litigating work or advising work, policy work for a few years, and then went into academia. One can assume that because of the U.S. Supreme Court clerkship, she would have had a lot of academic offers coming her way at the end of that clerkship. Now, in terms of broader qualifications, it is not uncommon for members of the Supreme Court to come from more of an academic background than a law practice background. In fact, it is not uncommon for federal judges at every level to come, especially the Court of Appeals level, to come from an academic versus a litigator background. Now, I am very much reminded with regards to Justice Ginsburg's record of the same record for Thurgood Marshall, who, you know, very few justices could have a Ginsburg litigation career. Thurgood Marshall is one of those who had more than a Ginsburg litigation career, right? And of course, I should say, let's remember that the late Justice Ginsburg was an academic before she took on Supreme Court litigation cases, right? But Thurgood Marshall's replacement, Clarence Thomas, did not have a very strong litigation background prior to his appointment to the court. So again, you could think of it as an issue of professional diversity. The other thing, or not, what I think is interesting with this pick is that we don't have someone who went to Harvard or Yale. We have someone who went to Notre Dame. To me, that's pretty significant. Also that this pick comes out of the Seventh Circuit as opposed to DC or those more popular places, DC, New York. We've got someone yet again, like Gorsuch, from the middle of the country, from a circuit that we just don't hear a ton about. And in some ways, I think that means that we get a little bit more diversity outside of race and gender than we're used to.
And you also brought up something about the time frame, like when Antonin Scalia passed suddenly and Merrick Garland was nominated back in 2016, I believe it was about 152 days before the election. When Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed on September 18th, like I mentioned, it was about 40 days before the election. An interesting note as well, though, is that the time from nomination to the start of the Senate hearings for the previous three Supreme Court justices, they took more than three times longer than this will take. The reason I bring that up, Shakira, is again, from a constitutional standpoint, there is nothing wrong with pushing this hearing through quickly.
Right. And so two things there. One, Amy Coney Barrett was recently appointed to the Seventh Circuit. I think it was 2017. So that's 3 years, right? It's not like it's been decades where there's a huge judicial record to pour over. And so I think that that may mitigate, at least in terms of those who support the nomination. I think for them that mitigates things. The other thing, however, is that the closer to the election, the more the pick, if it's a controversial pick, the more it could have a political implication for the president and the majority members of the Senate. And it's not as if the Senate majority has a huge majority where they could withstand in a highly contested election year where a pick will now happen or a confirmation will now happen 30 days before the election. And it's very well that the new justice could take her seat, you know, a week before the election. This will be very fresh on the voters' minds. And so if the voters don't like this, right, if the voters don't like the lack of clear rules, the sort of backseats on the rule from 2016. Mm-hmm. Then the voters, I think, play a higher role, a more important role in this selection process. It just comes all after this election. So in that respect, there may not be anything for voters to do to stop the pick, but there may be a lot that voters can do to mitigate the impact of the pick when they go and vote for the president and all of the people who are up for U.S. Senate.
So if she is appointed, and in all likelihood at this point, it looks like that will end up happening. Can we talk about the issue of whether she should recuse herself if there is a case in regard to the election? As you mentioned, she could be seated on the Supreme Court even before Election Day, maybe shortly after. There are rumblings that, this could very well end up in court if this does not go President Trump's way. So again, I would assume nothing unconstitutional if she chose not to recuse herself, but with it being so close to her taking her seat, what about this issue of recusing herself if we get to that point?
Well, it may be that, the rules for conflicts of interest for justices and all of our federal judges are pretty clear. And so even if her conscience, and I don't think conscience, right, or it makes people uncomfortable or people will be mad at me, is one of those reasons to recuse yourself from a case.
Right.
So it may be from the future justice's perspective that she has an obligation to sit on any case where she does not have a clear conflict of interest, as opposed to it just looks bad, right? If there's any evidence that would recuse her from a case dealing with President Trump and the election, then it would seem like that would be the type of evidence that would come out during the confirmation hearings as a reason to maybe say, hey, let's look at this nomination. Do you understand what I'm saying here, right? Any conflict that she's gonna have deciding the case around election would be basis for the Senate to sort of consider the nomination. So to me, it seems very unlikely that any of the justices would recuse themselves simply because President Trump nominated them or nominated them super close to an election. Mm. Again, I don't think the rules of judicial conduct say, hey, if you take your seat within a month of the election, you can't hear the case surrounding the election. That's just not really what's in the rule. Mm-hmm. So I would suspect that if there is a case to be decided, she would hear that case.
Can we talk a little bit about packing the court? We've started to hear about this. Can you explain what it is, and can that actually be done?
Mm-hmm. So like I said, the U.S. Constitution doesn't lay out the rules for how many justices there are, right? That's set by Congress. And so over our U.S. constitutional history, we've seen various different numbers of judges. We've stuck with 9 so far, but we've had even number of judges. We've had, I think, 5 judges before. So again, there's nothing in our Constitution that dictates the number of judges. All it says, once you're in there for life. So it's not like we could yank somebody because we say, right, Now we want 7, right? So to the extent that Congress decides they want to add more justices, Congress can do so. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot to limit Congress on making that decision. And of course, that's where I say voters could have a much more of an influence in the U.S. Supreme Court process than ever before, just because this election is so close. President Trump isn't going to have the luxury of the election being 3 years away when people would forget. This will probably be the number one thing COVID will probably be first on many people's minds. This will be in their top 3. So along with the economy. So it just sort of adds more. And it could be that, there are tons of people who would not have voted for Trump, but with this pick, they're on board. So I guess we'll just have to see November 3rd.
And before I let you go, you mentioned, you know, once a U.S. Supreme Court justice and for any federal judge is appointed there, it's a lifetime appointment. And there have been rumblings about this idea of, well, you know what, maybe we should set mandatory retirements. And I believe if I'm, you are the law expert, not me, but my understanding is one of the reasons to do a lifetime appointment is so that it does not end up being political, in the sense that if you are seated for a lifetime, that doesn't mean that you can't stray from, you know, as with Amy Coney Barrett, you know, being this conservative, if it's a lifetime appointment, you know, she doesn't have to stay in that lane. Right. Mm-hmm. There is no one that she is bound to, and no ideology that she is bound to, if it is a lifetime appointment versus a mandatory retirement. Am I correct in that thinking?
Yes. And let me make clear what the Constitution says is that, you know, courts hold their jobs, right, as long as they're exhibiting good behavior. And that's the only thing. So there is the ability to yank a judge if they engage in misconduct. But other than that, that is interpreted to mean that you have that lifetime appointment. Now, first of all, the basic understanding is that nominees to any federal court, you don't talk about your politics with the president at all. You're not supposed Correct. To be having conversations at all about what you may rule in one case versus another case. Now, of course, these are all very confidential conversations. So the likelihood of understanding what the exchange is unknown, right? Or is very little. Mm-hmm. But in general, even going into federal court, and that's why we see at confirmation hearings, judges at all levels say, I don't talk about politics. I won't tell you what I may do in a particular case. But you are right. To whatever the judge's philosophy is, politics, whatever, right? That mm-hmm. nothing holds you back when you get to that Supreme Court, except for your adherence to the rule of law and stare decisis, which is respect for prior decisions. And I think it's always important to remember that no one person is the Supreme Court. They're a member of the Supreme Court. So no justice on their own can change a rule or rule in a case. They can only do so with four other justices, at least, if they want a majority.
I thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy day. I know you just got out of class from teaching. So I appreciate you coming in and talking to us about this and really giving us a better understanding constitutionally about this process. It's so important that we understand that. Thank you so much.
I always appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
Absolutely. We have been talking with University of Idaho Law Professor Shakira Sanders. More Idaho Matters next.